We're in a How to Not Self-Destruct series. Last week, we started where I think that it all starts, and that is if you want to live a life of not self-destruction, it's admitting that left to yourself, to your own devices, that you will, that you indeed are your own worst enemy. And as we begin to admit that, then we begin to see that I need someone to save me other than me. I need someone to save me other than me. And last week we saw that that person who saves us is God through the person of Jesus. And as we come to him, he saves us. And that's the premise of this entire series, that we will self-destruct if left to ourselves. And yet there's a God who saves us and we want to walk in his salvation and his ways. So today we want to kind of continue a little bit in that vein. Today we're going to look at what do you do? What do we do when the light shines on you? And the reality is we all do something and we're all tempted to do something. We all do it, and yet when we see other people do it, we hate it. We hate it when other people do this. And yet we do and are tempted to do the very same things. What do you do when the light shines on you, on your failure, on your mistake, on your sin, and there's this temptation in us to redirect the light? To redirect the light, because we don't like what the light shows us. And so I'm going to use the word blame. I know blaming can be defined a few different ways, but the way I'm defining blaming, this deflection of light, is this way, that blaming is the result of an unwillingness to admit or own a mistake, wrong, or a fault. An unwillingness that when the light shines on you and you're like, oh man, my failure's been exposed, that blaming or this deflection is an unwillingness to say, yeah, that was me. And we deflect the light and we blame others. Now here's the reality about this kind of blaming, about this kind of deflection. Blaming actually leads to hopelessness. Blaming leads to hopelessness, both for the person who's doing the blaming when the light shines on them and they deflect the light to others. It leaves them hopeless, but it also leaves everyone in your sphere. It leaves everyone in your sphere hopeless. Let me explain a little bit. So why does blaming lead to hopelessness for the person doing the blaming? Here's why. Because you can't fix what ain't broke. None of us fix what isn't broke. And the moment the light shines on our brokenness and we deflect the light to others, in that moment we have become hopeless because we will never change because we are not the problem. You don't fix what ain't broke, and we become hopeless. But not only are we hopeless, everyone in our sphere becomes hopeless. Because I imagine that you've experienced this. At some point in your life, you have challenged someone or asked someone, maybe you shed the light on their brokenness, on their mistake. You said, hey, I would appreciate if maybe you wouldn't do this anymore, or you did this and it hurt me, or you did something that wronged me. And in the moment of your kind of confronting them, of your challenging them, they took the light that you shone on them and they blamed and they deflected and they said, oh, no, that wasn't me. That was because of this situation. Well, that's because of this circumstance. It really wasn't my deal. Or maybe in some cases, as you shone the light on their failure, they simply deflected the light back at you and said, no, it's because you. And in that moment, you left the conversation and you felt something, didn't you? I imagine at that moment you felt hopeless because the problem just left the room, didn't it? What you determined as the problem, that the problem was there in their deflection of the problem, saying, oh, actually, it's not me. It's suddenly there's a problem, but you can't deal with the problem because they have deflected the problem elsewhere. The problem has just left the room, and you felt hopeless because you knew the problem was still in the room, but it can't be fixed, and you had no hope of it ever changing. You felt hopeless. I want to be a little vulnerable this morning and share a little bit of a problem I have. Now, you just have to promise to never bring this up with me, and you can't tell my wife about this, okay? So she's serving upstairs right now. So I have a problem. You guys all know that I have many problems, but one of my problems, maybe you didn't know, is that I struggle with margin in my life. It's something I've struggled with for a lot of years, and I just struggle with margin in the sense that I think I can do more in a day than I can actually do. And it gets me in trouble because I book my schedule too full and then I end up running late for things. And this has become a challenge in our marriage because, you know, we'll have an appointment. Let's say we have an appointment at 5 o'clock and Mandy and I talk. My wife is Mandy, just, you know, I live with my wife. We have a talk and it's like, hey, you know, we have this appointment at 5 or we need to leave at 5 or they're coming at 5. Can you be home at 4:30? I'm like, look at my day. I'm like, yeah, definitely. I can be home at 4:30. Now, just so you know, it takes me about eight minutes to drive home and about 10 or 12 to 15 minutes to bike home. And so, you know, okay, I need to be home at 4:30. Our appointment's at 5. And so at precisely 4:29, I'm like, I better get going because I got to be home in 1 minute. Now, I'm a smart guy. I can do simple math. But for some reason, there's just this thing that plays in my head where it's like, well, the appointment's not till 5. And, you know, I can you know, do this. And so it's like 4:29. I'm like, all right, I can do this. But that's not the worst part or the only part of the problem. Undoubtedly, when I'm, you know, 4:29 sharp, I'm like grabbing my stuff ready to get out the door. Undoubtedly, Pastor Wayne shows up. And he just wants to have a conversation, right? You know, Pastor Wayne's a good guy. Just wants to have a conversation. Or, you know, Prisoner Pete shows up. Or the phone rings, like, Elvin, you're needed. And it's just like, oh, no. Here's the deal about my wife. My wife is awesome. She is completely 180% sold out on ministry, on my pastoral role. And so if I come home, I'm like, hey, you know what? I'm late. And she's all stressed. She's like, you were supposed to be home at 4:30. You didn't leave work till 5:01. I'm like, I know. And then I got home at 5:15 and I'm already late and now we're late. And I'm like, well, you know what? Pastor Wayne, right? Or Parishioner Peter, you know, the phone rang and I had to deal with this. My wife's awesome. And she'll just like, yeah, all in on ministry. Now, if that happened 85% of the time, she'd be like, I believe you. But when it happens 100% of the time, suddenly, she begins to feel hopeless. Because every time she says, yeah, but you're late again, you're late again, you're late again. And I say, well, it's not my fault. The problem's left the room and she has no hope that it could ever change. It could ever change. But here's the other deal. If I continue to shine the light at others, at situations, at circumstances, I become hopeless. Because I will never change, will I? Because I don't see the problem as me. It's not a margin problem. It's Pastor Wayne's problem. It's the situation's problem. It wasn't me. But the reality is, if I had built margin in my life, I would have been gone at 4:15 and Wayne wouldn't have got me. Prisoner Pete would have missed me and the phone would have rang and I would have been gone already, right? Anyways, besides the point. The point is, the problem is me. Now, there's going to be circumstances and situations out of my control. But if I don't own the problem, I become hopeless and those around me become hopeless as well. So enough about me and my vulnerability. What about you? In what areas of your life, when the light shines on you, are you tempted to deflect the problem, deflect the ownership, and blame others? Maybe it's with your self-control issue. Maybe it's your own tardiness. Maybe it's an uncontrolled tongue, and you fly off the handle and say things you shouldn't say, and you just never really saw it as your problem. It's other people. It's situations that come up. Maybe for you, it's drinking too much. But it's not your problem. I mean, it's the situation. It's people. Maybe for you, it's anger, lack of self-control. Maybe it's pride. But you're just so much better than everyone. Why does everyone else have to be so? In what area, when the light shines on you, are you tempted to deflect the light, to deflect the light? It will leave you hopeless. It will leave others in your life hopeless, and you will self-destruct. You will self-destruct. Well, today I want to look at a story in Scripture of a guy, when the light shone on him, he deflected the light, his self-destructing pathway. And in his story, we're going to see a lie, I think a foundational lie that we all believe that leads us to blaming others. That leads us, when the light shines on us, to say, I'm going to deflect that to others. And we're going to uncover this lie in his story. This is a story of Saul, the first king of Israel. If you have your Bibles, go to 1 Samuel chapter 13. 1 Samuel chapter 13. So just to give you a little bit of backdrop as to Samuel. The nation of Israel has come out of Egypt. They're in the promised land. They don't have kings yet. They just have judges, these rulers over their nation. And they're having these little scrimmages and some major wars against the surrounding people. And some they win, some they lose, but this is kind of what's going on. Well, eventually, the people say, hey, we want a little more security, so we don't want judges or prophets to rule over us. We actually want a king to rule over us. And the prophet or judge at that time was Samuel. And so they came to Samuel and said, would you put a king over us? So Samuel anoints Saul as the first king over Israel. One of the first things Saul does, actually his son does, right after he's king, one of the first things that happens, Jonathan, Saul's son, goes and attacks a Philistine outpost. Now the Philistines were the arch enemies of the nation of Israel. And he attacks their outpost, and Saul instantly knows, you know, the hornet's nest has just been stirred. And so he's like, we need to pull together an army. So he pulls together the army of Israel. One of the first times he does this as king, he's had a few other battles with the nation of Israel, but this is kind of one of the first times as a king he's led the nation into battle. But he's not the only one forming an army. In verse 5 of chapter 13, we read that the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. This is a bad situation when it's your first battle, isn't it? It's like, ah, shoot, they just showed up, and it's like, that's a lot of people, right? This is not a situation. They realize this is not a situation. When the Israelites saw that their situation was critical, which in essence means they realized, oh shoot, we're hooped, we're toast, we are done, right? When they realized this and that their army was hard pressed, they hid in caves and thickets among the rocks and in pits and cisterns. So here's, you know, Saul, one of his first armies, got he's got the army together, and oh shoot, they're all hiding behind rocks and thickets and cisterns and holes, right? It's like, this is a bad situation. Well, it gets worse for him. Some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan River, to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. Okay, so, you know, some of them, you know, are hiding behind rocks and stuff. Some of them, they just run, and they ran on the other side of the river. They're just running for the life. The few he's got left, I mean, they're so afraid, they're having a hard time holding their bladder, right? I mean, they're just like, they are really, really scared. This is a bad situation, a really bad situation. But it gets even more difficult for Saul. What I didn't tell you is a few chapters earlier in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 8, right after Saul was anointed king, Samuel said to him, he said, listen, Saul, I want you to go to Gilgal, which he has done, right? He's in Gilgal, and I want you to wait for 7 days. And I'm going to have a sacrifice, and we're going to do some things, but you just need to wait for 7 days. Now, let me just put this in perspective. This is Saul's, you know, one of his first battles. He's facing his arch enemies who have an army as numerous as the sand on the seashore. On top of that, some of his soldiers, well, half of his soldiers are hiding out behind rocks and holes in the ground and cisterns. The other half have, you know, gone on the other side of the Jordan. They're just running for their lives. The few of them he has left are peeing their pants in fear, right? I mean, this is just a bad, bad situation. In fact, it would lead us to kind of have this thought. You know, in some ways, if Saul's supposed to wait for 7 days, that's, you know, on top of all that, he's just supposed to wait, like do nothing, just wait. And we get this idea, you know, I think Saul's been set up to mess up, right? I mean, if you're in that situation, is any of us gonna like do it right? I mean, it's like the world's coming against him. He's been set up to mess up. Well, he thinks that as well. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So the few men he has left who are peeing their pants in fear are running away now as well. He is down and out, right? So he said, bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings. And Saul offered up the burnt offering, which was disobedience to not only Samuel, who had said, wait for me, it was disobedience to God. Because Saul, although he was king, did not have the right to offer the sacrifice. He was neither prophet, nor was he priest. And so he does something wrong. And just, you know, just as fate has it, because have you ever noticed fate always has it? Just as fate has it, just as he finished making the offering, guess who shows up? Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. And Samuel asked this question, "What have you done?" In essence, Samuel takes the light and he shines it on King Saul's failure. And he says, "What have you done?" And the question is, what will Samuel do with the light? What will Samuel do with the light? Well, here's what we're told he does. Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering and that you did not come at the set time and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash." As Samuel shines the light on Saul and his failure, Saul takes the light and it deflects it. And he deflects it, first of all, to his men who were scattering, right? I mean, this wasn't my fault, Samuel. This was a situation. Can you see? My guys are all running away. I had no other choice. And not only that, not only does he deflect the light to his circumstance, he deflects the light to Samuel. He says, no, don't look at me and say, what have I done? It's your fault. You didn't show up on time. Well, Samuel's like, it's still the seventh day. Yeah, but it was morning. It's late afternoon. You didn't come when you said, right? It's like, this is your fault. And on top of that, the Philistines were assembling. I mean, they were an army as numerous as the sand on the sea. And Saul believed the lie, a foundational lie that we all believe when we are tempted and given to the temptation to blame, to deflect the light as it shines on us. And the lie, well, we'll get to it. Before we get to that, he said, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor, right? So I need to do this. So I felt compelled. I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering. And that word compelled leads us into that lie that we all believe when we give into deflecting the light. And that lie is this: I was set up to mess up. I was set up to mess up, which means I am simply a product of my situation. I am a victim. Don't put the blame on me. Deflect the light to others. It's not my fault. It's your fault. It's their fault. It's the situation. I have been set up to mess up. In what areas of your life are you tempted to believe this lie? You're simply a product of a situation, that you've been set up to mess up, that you're a victim. You know, maybe for you, it's your drinking. And you have some dad wounds, or there's some things that happen at work, or there's some things in your marriage, and whenever the light shines on your abuse of that substance, something in you deflects the light and says, it's not me. It's the situation. It's their fault. I'm just a victim. I've been set up to mess up. Maybe for you, it's your lack of self-control. And every time the light shines on your inability to control your emotions, that you just deflect the light. You're like, if you knew my coworkers, it's their fault. You deflect the light. If you knew my kids and they never clean up and I just lose it, see how we deflect the light and we don't want to own our own stuff? You know, maybe for you, there's some financial things you've done and you're like, yeah, but it wasn't my, if the government hadn't have, if the economy, and we just deflect the light because we don't like the light shining on our own failure. You know, maybe for you, it's gossip, it's slander, and every time the light shines on you, you'd say, well, you know what they said about me? And you deflect the light, and I was just set up to mess up. I'm a victim in this situation. Here's the deal. Every time you believe that lie and take that lie and live by that lie, you self-destruct. You're hurting yourself. You're hurting those around you because you leave them hopeless. You'll never change because you don't think you're the problem. And you destroy your relationship with God himself. So I want to encourage you with some truth today. Here's the truth. You are not the product of your situation. You are not the product. That the things that you do are not something that you have no choice in. Rather, you can, I want to tell you today, you can walk past your problems. But here's the deal, before you can walk past your own problems, you must own your own problems. Before you can walk past your own problems, you must own, 100% own your own problems. And I'll tell you what, this won't be easy. Everything is against you from doing this. Your humanity itself is against you, and I think our society is against us. Your humanity is against you doing this because you are the product, your human self is the product of the first human beings. And the very first beings, the first human beings on earth, Adam and Eve, when the light shone on them, do you know what they did? Deflected the light. And God came into the garden and said to Adam first, he said, Adam, what have you done? And as he says, I'm shining the light. He does what Samuel does with Saul, right? He shines the light on Adam. And Adam says, it's the woman you gave me. I'm just the victim of this woman, right? It says, like, I was set up to mess up. And God says to the woman, what have you done? And she says, it's the serpent. See, here's the deal. Your own humanity plays against you in owning your own stuff. It's so, so difficult. But there's another reason this becomes so difficult, because even in our own society and our culture plays against us in this. You know, in our society, we label everything. Everything has a name. Everything has a label. Every difficult thing you've gone through, every mistreatment you've gone through, every struggle you have, there is a label for it. And here's the deal. Labels can be very, very helpful. Extremely helpful. Because labels can help us say, oh, okay, I'm struggling with this. Here's a pathway out. And, oh, I'm dealing with this. Here's a pathway out. But here's the deal. Although labels can be helpful to identifying some things and some pathways through, labels have a dark side. And the dark side of the label is the dark side of labels is that we don't just identify, but that label becomes our identity. And then we begin to hide behind that identity. And we say, well, it's not my fault. I'm just a product of my situation. That this happened to me as a child. I have some daddy wounds. I have some things that happened in my past. This is just who I am. So yes, I drink too much. Yes, I have self-control issues. Yes, I have this problem. Yes, I'm late all the time, but it's not my fault because of this label. And so I'm not saying that labels are all bad, but there is a dark side. A dark side. Because we can hide behind a label and it becomes our identity. But you can walk past your problems. But you must first own your problems. And so I want to tell you today, you are not the product of your situation. You are not the product. Saul was not the product of his situation. But I think we could agree with Saul, and I think we could agree with our own situation. He was definitely vulnerable, wasn't he? Right? Saul was so vulnerable. I mean, brand new king, one of his first wars, his army's fleeing. The Philistines is numerous. There's the sand and the seashore are coming. He's supposed to wait and do nothing. He was in a vulnerable place. A vulnerable place. But here's the deal. Even when we are vulnerable, we are still responsible. Even when we are vulnerable, we are still responsible. I don't know what makes you vulnerable to your difficulty. Maybe it's when you're tired. Maybe it's when you're lonely. And it's like, I'm just lonely. And you look at some things online you shouldn't look at. Or you engage in an emotional relationship with someone who's not your spouse that you shouldn't be engaging in. Because you're lonely. You're vulnerable, right? Maybe your vulnerability is a building. It's a place. It brings back memories. Maybe your place of vulnerability is when you're tired, and it's just like, when I'm tired or when I'm hungry, I can't control myself, and I lose it. But here's the deal. Even when we're vulnerable, whatever that vulnerability is, we are still responsible. You know, if we're going to walk past our problems, we have to own our problems. And so here's, I think, the posture we should all take, the posture that can lead us out from deflecting the light, and that is this. It's receiving this truth. I am 100% responsible for 100% of my actions. I am 100% responsible for 100% of my actions. In fact, this is so important that I want us all to say this out loud together, okay? So even those of you watching online or you're listening to a podcast driving, say this out loud right now with me, okay? I am 100% responsible for 100% of my actions. And do you know what that means? That means you are not responsible for other people's actions on you. You're not responsible for that. You're not responsible for circumstances and situations that life throws at you, but you are 100% responsible for how you respond in that circumstance, in that situation, regardless of what it is. And as you begin to own that, 100% of you, you will begin to walk past your own problems. Well, Saul didn't accept this. And he blamed and he redirected the light, and it was costly. In fact, we're told it cost him this. You have done a foolish thing, Samuel said. In essence, he said, you just self-destructed. Let me tell you how this cost you. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. You just lost the kingdom. He just started. It's like one of his first battles as king, and he's lost the kingdom already. Not only that, but now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. This cost Saul the kingdom. And as we read the context, the verses, it's clear he lost the kingdom because of disobedience. You have not kept the Lord's command. You disobeyed the Lord, and because of your disobedience, you've lost the kingdom. But here's what I would argue, although that is 100% true, I think what is also true, what's added to this, is the context of the entire story. And as we look at the entire story of Saul and David, we realize Saul did not only lose the kingdom because of his disobedience, but because of his heart posture. That every time God shone the light on his failure, he redirected the light. And we see this because the man that God would choose, this man after his own heart, he would fail and sin just as David, or just as Saul did. He would sin just as Saul did. And yet when God shone the light on David's sin, even though he had been disobedient, David ended up retaining the kingdom because he owned 100% of his own actions, 100% of his own actions. So here's what I want to leave with you. This is the one kind of line I want to leave with you. I want you to remember. It's cheesy, but it rhymes, so it'll be memorable. But here's what I want to leave with you. When you mess up, fess up. When you mess up, fess up. And the reason I don't like this a lot is because fess up just feels like, you know, when I mess up, I'm just going to say sorry, and then I'm going to go mess up again, and I'll say sorry, and I'll just keep messing up and fessing up and messing up and fessing up. But that's not what I mean. When you mess up, confess, own 100% of what you've done. And as you allow the light to shine on you and you refrain from redirecting the light will begin to cleanse and change you. You have hope. The light of Christ changes us. It cleanses us. And so when you mess up, fess up, own it before God, own it before others, and allow the light that shone on your failure to begin to cleanse you. See, here's the thing. I think for many of us, we're afraid to fess up. We're afraid to confess our sin, to allow other people to know it because we think they're going to be so hard on us and they're going to judge us and they're going to be against us. But I want you to know, people, I think, are way more gracious and forgiving than we give them credit for. They're more forgiving and gracious than we give them credit for. And I believe if you confess what you've done wrong to those around you, do you know what will happen? It will actually build trust in them. You will begin to build trust because here's the deal. Most of your failures, the people around you already know, right? And when you deflect the light, you're just losing trust. Every day you deflect the light, you're leaving them hopeless. And the moment you come in and say, the light shone on me, and I own this, you build trust, and I think they'll be more willing than you realize to forgive you, to forgive you. But here's the deal. Even if they don't forgive you, God is way better than any of us. And in 1 John 1:9, we're told that if we confess our sins, He, God, is faithful and just, which means every single time he responds this way, when we confess, when we own our sin before him, he will forgive us our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. That's the light of God. That's the light of Christ as it shines on us. As we own that, his light begins to cleanse and purify and change us. But if we will deflect it, we will remain in our own problems and we will remain hopeless. I love how David, that man after God's own heart, I love how he said it about the self-destructing pathway of deflecting the light, of not owning our sin. Just after he had slept with another man's wife and then had the man killed to cover up his adultery, he wrote this psalm, and he says this. He says, "When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. As the light was shining on my own failure, but I wouldn't own it, and I kept covering, I kept deflecting the light, I was wasting away, I was self-destructing. But then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I owned 100% of my own actions. And I said, I will confess my transgressions, my sin, my failure. I will confess to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin." And when you mess up, would you take a new posture of confession, of ownership and confession? And I guarantee you, in your relationships with those around you, just ahead, that there is all kinds of forgiveness and reconciliation in your relationships right now, just ahead of you. It's within your grasp, but it's just around the corner of you owning your sin. There's so much reconciliation just ahead of you, but it's just around the corner of you owning your own sin. And when it comes to your relationship with God, do you know that there is life, full, abundant life, forgiveness, as David acknowledged, just ahead of you? It's just around the corner of you owning your sin and then living for him. Owning your sin and living for him. So how do we live with this posture? How do we repel the posture that Saul took? I want to leave two things with you that can be helpful. First one is this: watch your mouth or watch your language. Especially when the light shines on you. Every time the light shines on you and your failure, your mistakes are kind of brought to life, just pay attention to the words that come out of your mouth. And if the first words out of your mouth are, "Yeah, but," "Well, you should have seen what," "Hey, you," if you wouldn't have, just watch your language. It will go a long ways in revealing what's happening in your own heart. And the second thing is, and this is kind of stolen from Freedom Session, give up your victim card. The words I used earlier from Saul was that idea, that lie, that I've been set up to mess up. I'm a product of my situation. I'm the victim. And all of us have a victim card. All of us carry along the way some area of our life where when the light shines on, we're just tempted to say, "Well, yeah, it's not, if you just knew." And last week I said, there's going to be calls in this series to surrender to God some things we don't want to surrender. And maybe for you, that's a victim card that you've carried, and you don't want to deal with what's been happening in your own heart, in your own life, in your own sin. And every time the light shines on you, you pull out your victim card and deflect the light. I would encourage you to do some business with God and say, "God, I don't want to carry the victim card anymore. God, I accept that I am 100% responsible for 100% of my actions, and I will own my actions. Even when I'm vulnerable, I will still claim responsibility. I will own my own stuff." And when you mess up, fess up. Just around the corner, just ahead in your life, there's all kinds of life and forgiveness and reconciliation waiting for you. But it's just around the corner of you owning your sin and living for him. Let me pray with you. Father, thank you for your word that cuts through all our barriers and our defenses, and it touches our hearts. God, I know that this is a scary thing for many of us because we have tried to self-protect by not owning our sin, by deflecting the light. We've tried to self-protect because we didn't want people to know and we didn't want to own. And yet in our desire for self-protection, we have gone down the pathway of self-destruction. And God, I pray that we today would come before you first and foremost, that we have sinned before you, that we would bring our sin, we would stop hiding or covering or deflecting, that we would own our sin before you. I pray that we would also own it before others. And that in this act of confession, in this act of ownership, that your light, the light of Jesus that shines on us, is not a condemning light. It's a forgiving, freeing, life-giving light. And may we walk in freedom in the life you called us to, the life you, Jesus, died on the cross to give us, as we bring our sin before you and allow it to be paid for, which it's been paid for on the cross of Jesus. Give us that strength to go down that pathway, we pray. Amen. Thanks so much for joining us today. We trust you have been encouraged and challenged in your faith journey. If you're desiring prayer, want more information on our church, want to partner with us, or be involved in any way, please go to our website at mountoliveefc.com. We'll see you next time.